I call the City Council meeting for November 23rd to order. Councilmember Bayrou, would you lead us all in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
Are you begin?
The Pledge of Allegiance is to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Councilmember Bayrou. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Kelly?
Here.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Bayrou?
Here.
And Mayor Fonzie?
Here.
And the record will reflect that Mayor Pro Tem O'Malley is absent.
Thank you, Marcia. And before we approve the agenda, Councilmember Bayrou would like to make a presentation.
Yes, as a few of you noticed, I didn't run for City Council, and so I did have some funds left over in the Friends of Ellen Bayrou campaign fund, and I would like to give that tonight to the Friends of the Library in their effort to...
Come on up, Grinda.
It's not big and beautiful.
Guess I could say how much it was, huh? It's for $1,000. So we will be, Friends of Ellen Bayrou will be founders.
Grinda, did you wish to speak?
I certainly do. Council Member Bayrou for this wonderful gift. And you are certainly going to be one of the founders of the library. And I also want to thank you for your service to the community. You've always done what was the right thing to do in your thinking, and I think you've done a wonderful job. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's move on to approval of the agenda. Roll call vote, or is anyone that would like to pull any item or change any items on the agenda? Let's go ahead and have a motion.
Move approval.
Second.
Motion by Councilmember Bayrou, second by Councilmember Kelly. Let's have a roll call vote.
Councilmember Bayrou.
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly.
Yes.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Mayor Fonzie.
Yes.
4-0 motion passes.
Thank you, Marcia. Our next item on the agenda is the consent calendar, and I would like to pull item 2. Is there anyone else on the council that would like to pull an item? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to pull an item from the consent calendar? Seeing none, we'll go back to our consent calendar and vote for an approval of items 1 and 3. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Councilmember Clay, second by Councilmember Bayrou. Roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Bayrou?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Fonzie?
Yes.
4-0 motion passes.
Thank you, Marcia. The reason I asked for the council to pull number 2 to discuss a little further is in my imagination, are we having a little bit of an issue with the sound? Okay, very good. I was concerned because the packet was very large for those who were wishing to bid on the Old City Hall project. And I know that the architect had wanted to put in certain things in terms of historical building experience and also FEMA experience, but I feel that this may be limiting it so that...
Special considerations that need to go into some of the materials. The materials need to be stored special ways as they're removed during the building and recreated, in some cases, cleaned or taken care of. And we certainly want to advise contractors, certainly advise, and that's why part of the whole pre-qualification issue is to make sure that the contractors are familiar with this kind of work so that someone doesn't provide us a very low bid or a lower bid and then not be able to completely accomplish the work or not do the work in a protective or a FEMA-friendly way, if you will. It is important both in the FEMA area, FEMA funding, and the myriad of regulations that we need to comply with on the FEMA side, as well as on the historical construction side. And Rochelle and Larry Fugel from Bernard's can speak specifically to the code sections, but that we need to follow the Secretary of Interior rules. And so we tried to lighten up the regulations so that it did apply to a broader audience, especially by reducing some of the FEMA requirements, because FEMA is the more difficult more people have worked on a historical building than have worked on FEMA. We have found with these new qualifications that there are at least seven construction companies in the Southern California area, two here in San Luis Obispo County, that have already said that they would bid on this project. And certainly others in the area can become affiliated with historic consultants that could advise them on the kind of historic asset we do have. It is a National Register building, and so it is of particular concern. You can relax these regulations, but we're sort of balancing risk. The more we reduce the regulations, their work on historic buildings, the more we take that risk that they may not appropriately or may not know or protect themselves in the handling of the variety of historical materials and tasks, if you will, that are required in our own building. And so we're recommending, as in the staff report, the level that we have. If you want to discuss a lesser regulation, we could try to explore that with you.
If we were to relax it a little bit, if we were, for instance, not to require that they had worked on
of the Federal Register regulations or the Department of Interior regulations, as opposed to National Register or the age of the building. And so I guess if you were actually to try to relax those standards, we would encourage you to go toward having participated in historical construction that complied with or that worked with or that was under the auspices of the Secretary of Interior standards. And we don't think that that's much of a reduction, really, from where you are. But if you wanted to try to change that language to see if that modified the it still would. You know, that's going to have the same sort of impact on the local contractors, which I think is the goal here, is your goal is to try to include some of those. Mm-hmm. The same historical consultants, frankly, that we have been working with that are available in the market, I think cover all of those same areas. So when you start changing out Secretary of Interior standards for the National Register, I'm not sure that we're changing the pre-quals very much, but we could do that.
I have a question for Mr. Fugel here, unless others on the council have questions for staff.
I just got one question while he's getting up.
Go ahead.
Wade, prior to this amendment, how many contractors were able to bid?
We think one.
Just one. Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Councilmember Barrow.
Wade, I have a question. This is a prevailing wage job, correct? Okay, so
yes.
We have a certain expectation of how much it's going to cost and what quality work we want. I'm concerned that if we're too loose, I guess this is what the discussion is about, that we won't get the quality that we need for this building. So, okay, go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, well, that's kind of my concern, too. We want a good job. Locals built the building originally, and I would hope that locals could repair it. That's kind of where I'm coming from. I'd like to see our contractors involved more, if we possibly could. So I was wanted to ask you, since Bernard's would be the overseer of all the other contractors that are applying for particular jobs, wouldn't Bernard's be able to monitor their abilities and make sure that the work is done correctly?
The importance of, I think in answer to that question, I would have to restate sort of the importance of the Secretary of the Interior's contemporary use. However, these repair and alterations must not damage or destroy materials, features, or finishes that are important in defining the building's historic character. For example, certain treatments, if improperly applied, may cause or accelerate physical deterioration of the historic building. This can include using improper repointing or exterior masonry cleaning techniques, or introducing insulation that damages historic fabric, In almost all of these situations, use of these materials and treatments will result in a project that does not meet the standards. It's important to understand the risk that, Wade talked about. If we get sideways with the regulations under the Secretary of the Interior standards, we risk funding. First of all, because those repairs must be made in accordance with those standards as determined. Second of all, if the contractor is not does not have the expertise to monitor those in the field on a day-to-day basis, those trades that are applying those standards, you run the risk of having to rework, and that would mean additive change orders to the project. So you could find yourself in a position of increasing your project budget because your contractor doesn't have the expertise to manage his subs. One of the things that I think might be slightly misunderstood is the level of potential local participation for bid package 8. This package is a super package of various trades, and if you go to the city website and look on the link to the historic preservation or the historic rehabilitation project, and you scroll down to that particular item on this website, you see a list of all of the different trade packages that are included in the bid package. That's a very extensive and diverse list of trades that would be involved. Some conversation that we're having might include a recommendation to the city to relax its standard of 30% general contractor participation and have to increase the sub participation above 70%. Patient concern that of that package, worth saying that potentially more than 70% of that would not be the general contractor that we are pre-qualifying, and that the more than 70% would be of the ability for locals.
I think I understand, but this is not our area of expertise, and it is yours, that I'm assuming that the general contractor will not have his hands on the boards or in the plaster or on the bricks, but they will be supervising, so he would make sure that the subcontractors who will be doing the actual work are qualified to do so.
He will provide the expertise in order to make sure that those subs are doing the work in accordance with the Secretary of the Interior standards.
And so will they be somehow screened so you as the overseer know that they have the expertise to do the work themselves?
The screening will have to come through the general contractor and his expertise. Yes, Bernard's will be able to apply our knowledge of that as well as the FEMA standards, but on a day-to-day basis, this is why it's so important to have a contractor that has this expertise, who has worked within the Secretary of the Interior standards previously, to understand what those nuances and what those are. Again, the piece that I read from you sort of indicates that there are general industry practices for the application of a certain material, but under the Secretary of the Interior standards for a historic facility, those industry standards need to change in order for that contractor to understand how those would be applied to a historic structure. So there's nuances that have to be applied based on his expertise and having worked on historic facilities previously.
So, Mr. Fugel, have you reviewed the bid process and you feel that this is what we need to have not only a good job but one that is economically done and incorporates local contractors?
I have reviewed the bid package. I believe that the basis for this bid package being configured as it is, which includes everything that has to do with the historic fabric of that facilities, is appropriate, absolutely appropriate. I believe that the pre-qualification, the relaxation of the FEMA portion of the pre-qualification, but the maintenance of the strenuous historic experience qualification, pre-qualification, is vital. I really believe that that will reduce risk in a number of areas to the city. And as a construction manager, it'll make all of our
first paragraph It indicates that Bernard's has been communicating with potential contractors on the package. Through that process, Bernard's has received valuable feedback that prompted a reevaluation of the FEMA-related scoring section of the pre-qualification procedure. It's not clear to me who or what prompted the this reevaluation, and I'm just curious, was it mandated by FEMA, and has FEMA approved the proposed change? It's just that question.
Thank you, Mr. Brenler. Would anyone else like to speak on this topic? Seeing none, I'll close it to the public and bring it back to answer Mr. Brendler's question regarding the reevaluation.
The reevaluation was basically prompted due to a number of discussions with contractors. As we were talking to contractors, or as Bernard's was talking to contractors, trying to find out who might bid on this job, trying to get the word out to as many contractors as possible, it became obvious that meeting both the historic requirements and the FEMA earthquake seismic requirements was quite difficult. Luckily, we have not had a significant number of earthquakes in this area in recent years. Certainly San Simeon, you have to go back to Northridge and Loma Prieta. It's been a while. And so trying to find those contractors that have had that dual experience in the last 5 years was difficult. We sat down and we tried to evaluate where were our biggest risks. Was it going to be on the FEMA funding side, or was it going to be more on the historic side, and which was going to jeopardize it the most? We felt that we had enough experience in-house to monitor the FEMA funding side better, knowing where the potential pitfalls were of that. The FEMA funding requirement was a city requirement. It was not something that was required by FEMA. We certainly keep FEMA in the loop of what we're doing at all times, but they don't approve or disapprove our requirements. That is a council decision.
Thank you. Very good. Can I have a motion to approve or modify item 2?
Move approval of staff's recommendation.
Second.
Motion by Councilmember Bayrou, second by Councilmember Clay. Roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Bayrou?
Yes.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Fonzie?
Yes.
4-0, motion passes.
Thank you for your patience with me. I just wanted to make sure we were getting every possible chance to get the locals involved. Updates from the city manager.
The trees are currently scheduled to be removed the week of December 20th. The ACH2, the bid package 2, penthouse demolition, is currently out to bid. A mandatory walkthrough is scheduled for next Tuesday, the 30th at 1 at Bernard's office, and bid packages are available so people can call Bernard's office and get those bid packages right now to make sure we try to get some more local contractors involved. With the City Hall project, my next slide, up and running, we're working hard to include local folks to help ensure that the construction dollars, as you just mentioned, stay local. The city's launched an extensive outreach campaign to ensure that local contractors, vendors, laborers, and others are kept informed about the opportunities with the project. For local contractors, just let me tell you a few, all the bid packages are advertised on the city's website, in local plan rooms, and in the Atascadero News. We meet twice a month with the San Luis Obispo Builders Exchange representatives to keep them updated on the project. And contractors can contact Bernard's at 470-3190 to be put on a courtesy email list where contractors are emailed our bid packages and updates. The city will hold a meet and greet on January 26th for potential contractors and subcontractors to get together and exchange materials. The city continues to issue press releases and website updates to get the word out when new bid packages are becoming available, and our staff, along with Bernard's, are continuing to attend community events and organizational events to get the word out about potential opportunities to connect with the City Hall project. Bid packages, the tentative bid package release dates, and a wealth of other information is available on the website, which we hopefully are keeping up to date, very current. The local participation section is included in each bid package, and that's where there's opportunities for Councilmember Clay to eat locally here in Atascadero, and where there are places to stay and other things, so that contractors will continue to use, and our suppliers, local vendors, For vendors, the project's not only an opportunity for contractors, but also vendors. The Chamber of Commerce is included in our outreach committee, and they're helping us to get the information out to their members and others on the project. The Chamber's working on information packages, once again, to show vendors. In fact, I got all the cards from the Tool Outlet to make sure that they were in Bernard's. If somebody breaks a hammer, go to Tool Outlet to fix your hammer. 10, 20 or more employees to fill their ranks along with some of their people if they received a bid on the project. So there'd be a lot of individual opportunities to be involved in City Hall as well. As we jump to Colony Square, as you can see, that project's looking great. The paint colors are coming out. Those are really the paint colors for the final product. The marquee area is looking great. The interior is coming together. There's a variety of great slides on our initial opening session, too. As you can see, the building's being painted. We expect the theater to be open March 1st, 2011, and we expect the grand opening to coincide with the film festival, the SLO International Film Festival, on January 5th, 2011. We hope there's a giant kickoff both for Galaxy and for the film festival. And let me wrap up by saying that the draft environmental impact report for Walmart will be released the first week of January 2011.
Very good. Any questions for the city manager? Thank you, Wade. It's time for our community forum, and this is a time for anyone in the audience that would like to speak to the council on an item that is not on the agenda tonight to approach the podium, please.
Madam Mayor, I'm Tom Gaddis, council, staff. I represent about 13 churches. We meet weekly. We're very committed to praying for our city. We're all in agreement of and excited about the how this city has moved forward in 2010. We have great expectations that 2011 is going to be even better. So it's my privilege to pray, and I invite the audience, any that would like to join me among staff and council, to pray with me. Father in heaven, your scripture is very clear that every good and perfect gift comes down from you. And our daily lives, Lord God, are filled with an extraordinary amount of blessing. It's not luck, it's not chance, it's not by personal fortune or personal savvy. Lord, it's your blessing that has touched our lives. We sit here in this chamber, and it's your blessing that has taken what we have and made it more than enough. You have blessed our meals and made them feasts. You've blessed our houses and made them homes. You've of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pastor Gaddis.
Good evening, Madam Mayor and Council. My name is Ray Wyman. I am an Atascadero resident. And this being the last voting session for Councilmember Bureau, I want to make a few remarks about her service. Particularly, I want to say something first about her family. Many, many years ago, when my children were about the age of her children, my wife served a term on the Tucson City Council while working part-time and raising our three children. So I know firsthand the sacrifices that her family has had to make. So to them, I want to say that I hope you are as proud of her service as I am. And like Ellen, my wife cast votes that were sometimes very unpopular, but in retrospect now seem to be far-sighted. And to the general public, I can say that her votes on this council have been cast without regard to whether they were popular with either those who often opposed her or with those who generally agreed with her, but were based only on what she felt would be in the best interests of all the citizens of Atascadero. In my eyes, she is the role model for what a public servant should be. So, Ellen, I express my admiration and respect for your dedication and integrity, and I offer my best wishes for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wyman.
Good evening, City Council and staff. I'm Lee Perkins, and I live in Atascadero. Yes, tonight's Ellen's last night on the other side of the city council chamber. She'll be joining us over here very soon, I'm sure. And I have just a few things to recognize her for. She's a model for other young women and mothers. She had the courage to stand up for her convictions no matter what the majority said, such as for no smoking in the public parks, no layoffs in these hard economic times, cutting 3 trees at the city hall instead of 5, consistent support of the library, support of environmentally sound development, and most particular development in our downtown. Ellen has grown tremendously as a city council member, and I believe we'll see her back. Thank you.
Promote the city of Atascadero in a very business-friendly way, simultaneously ensuring that it would be done, the development would be done in an environmentally friendly way. I've worked with Ellen on and off the field, so to speak, here in this chamber, and as a professional colleague in the healthcare field, working with the criminally insane. That's no easy task, as you might imagine. Ellen brings the same approach to those issues, no matter what the locale that she's working in. I really appreciate her thoroughness in researching the issues, her scientific approach to the facts, and their application to the issues at hand, her critical thinking skills to explore options and solutions to problems, and her ability to listen and be open to new ideas and making compromises, which, of course, being in the minority most of the time, that was inevitable at times. But also voting alone, as it's been mentioned, maintaining a very principled stand on some matter. I know it wasn't easy for her. With less than 6 months into her term, she was faced by a recall, attempted recall by the political ideologues of the right here in the city. And thankfully, the citizens of Atascadero saw through that for the bogus attempt that it was in terms of trying to overthrow a democratically elected council member in our city. But Ellen has persevered, and she served, I believe, in the best interests of our community. And it's very understandable why she didn't run again. She has a young family, as has been mentioned. She's working, and she works on a business. And so I'd like to take this time to thank you very much, Ellen, for your service.
Thank you, Mr. Komar.
Hello, Council. My name is Jules Karkneg, and I am a resident of Atascadero. The reason I'm here tonight, I know it's not on the agenda, but it regards the crosswalk at the south end of town. I have a bunch of signatures. I don't really know the process of how to go about getting something like this taken care of. Basically, the reason I'm here tonight with my son Kyler and his little buddy Juan is on Thursday, another person was hit in the crosswalk, and this is 6 in the last 12 months. The girl that was hit by a blinking light system that's across from the Sunken Garden. Our crosswalk at our end of town has no light. I took a walk in it about an hour and a half before we left to come here just to see. And once again, I was almost hit. My 10-year-old in blue has almost been hit. Juan is a neighbor child. His brother has almost been hit. And it's a daily thing. And I don't know what the process would be. Where I grew up in a town back east where, you know, it was before the blinking cross lights, but it was a small town. And when something like that happened, it was a big travesty, and everybody stood up and made some changes. And I don't know the process or how to go about. So if you have any information, I've gone on the internet, and it's just a big vicious circle. I've gotten the information from the 5 major corporations in the world that make the blinking light systems. I know that we overpaid for ours, and the one by Sunken Garden, they are available from $8,000 all the way up to $25,000. We are requesting a blinking light. We're also requesting warning lights and maybe a reduction in the speed limit because I think 40 or 45 is a little fast for cars. They don't even see the kids in the crosswalk in broad daylight, let alone in the evening. And we just want to create a safe, cohesive environment for our children and for our neighbors. So if you have any input on where I can drop these signatures off of concerned citizens, and maybe somebody can let me know how to handle this.
Could I ask a question?
We have a question for you, sir. Go ahead.
It's pretty dark, too. I mean, I know the blinking lights would help, but
yeah.
The crosswalk itself is very dark. I mean, there's...
We do have the one street light at the corner of El Bordeaux. It's right there on the corner by Bloom and Grow Floral, which is right across from Chalk Mountain Liquors.
So that helps some? Or
It lights the crosswalk. I can see it driving at night, and my vision's not the best, but I can see it. But I also know the crosswalk's there. Right. We have no warning signs as you approach from the south or the north.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And we will be talking about this when we get all the other people with a chance to speak first.
Okay. So, will there be like a notice sent out for when it's on the agenda or something?
We will get back to you on that one, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Madam Mayor, City Council, City Staff. I didn't have any idea that gentleman right there came to talk about it, but I came to talk about the same thing. My daughter was the second car back from the lady.
Sir, I'm sorry. Could you state your name for
Mike Anderson. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Anyway, my daughter was the second car that was behind the lady that hit the lady in the mobility scooter. The lady in the mobility scooter was an older lady in her house because she's afraid to cross it. But I think Atascadero is a great place. I know we got a great council, great staff, great workers. And if anybody can figure this out, all of you can do it. But as far as I'm concerned, I spend a lot of miles every day and hours driving around this town. As far as I'm concerned, this is the biggest safety concern the town has right now. And I don't know how we would fix it, but it definitely needs to get fixed because right now we just had injuries. But I feel at the rate we're going, sooner or later, there's going to be a fatality there. And I don't think any of us want to know that and everything. And like I say, as far as the crosswalk at Sunken Gardens, I personally don't like that one because if you know the high school kids come out, it's like an ant trail going across, and it's miserable, and it's a half a block away from a signal. Now, the other one they put down by the Mark IV Patty's Pizza Plaza down there, I think if the people could just push a button and that would signal, then they would wait. Then when the light came on, they would go. In the daytime, the signs they put up are nice. It does show there's a crosswalk. It's a lot safer in the daytime. But at night, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. And like I say, if anybody can figure it out, all of you can do it. And I know we don't have a lot of money, but this is really a critical thing. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
My name is Fred Frank, resident of Atascadero. And I'd like to thank Ellen Barreau for her service. Sometimes it was difficult. And I know service on the council, and I'd like to direct this to Madam Mayor and the rest of the council, is not easy. There's a lot of homework to be done. And Ellen always did her homework very well. And I really appreciate that. I particularly appreciate the work you've done toward bike paths and bike plan for the community, your interest in energy conservation, alternative energy. I think that's something that will be reflected in our community for many years to come. And I'm not going to go over some of the things that were mentioned before, but I certainly support everything that was said about you. You have done an exemplary job, and we're going to miss you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frank.
Good evening. My name is Dan O'Grady. I live in Atascadero, and I am here this evening with Ticular for her sensitivity to the environmental aspects of the myriad issues that come before this council. And so, Ellen, on behalf of the Atascadero Land Preservation Society, a job well done. And Chairperson Fonzie, with your permission, I would like to present some of nature's beautiful gifts to Councilmember Barreau.
Of course. Come up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Grady, Mr. Boniface, and Mr. Chisholm.
Mayor and City Council and staff, my name is Bill Schaefer, and I have not attended a lot of your meetings, but I've attended a few that have been educational and exciting. I want to thank Ellen Barreau from a little different perspective. I'm probably more toward the right than she is on some issues. And looking at, the two young men here, Juan and Tyler and Juan, I think, yeah. Tyler and Juan are kind of why I'm here. What I was thinking about this earlier today, I wasn't sure I was going to come, but I thought with Ellen leaving, it would be appropriate to come and just thank her for her service. And the biggest issue that I would like to address with Ellen is her inclusion. We talk about sensitivity to the land, and I know the other council members all struggle with the same issues. You've got points that you're trying to get across, and you're trying to form coalitions to do that in. But I wonder if we would all be proud of the way that we are open to ideas and people on the council and in public if these two young gentlemen were here every session. And so that's kind of why I'm here. Ellen has been very open to somebody who doesn't particularly come from the issues that she's championing, and I might represent that on some issues. I think we've been in total agreement, but a number of them that we might not. And I just find that simple acceptance and encouragement and frankly, outreach to get a diverse opinion very, very professional, and the kind of thing that all of us really, I think, struggle for. And so I think just from that one aspect, Ellen, I would like to thank you for making one of the right-wing ideologues here feel comfortable in providing input and for your courtesy.
Good evening, Mayor, Council and staff. Michael Latner, resident of Atascadero and president of Vision Atascadero. And on behalf of Vision Atascadero, we'd like to personally thank Ellen Barreau for her public service. Her leadership has been noted by previous speakers, so I won't take time, but it is worth noting that she's been ahead of her time, I think, on several issues. As a behavioral scientist, I take a somewhat different tack, and I like to quantify action and look at patterns and things. And so one of the things I did was look at roll call votes during Ellen's term. And while it might be expected that she was in the majority more earlier in her career than in the end, what I did notice was that there weren't any more single votes or lone wolf votes voting alone. She wasn't more likely to vote alone than some other members on the council. And I think that speaks to a true mark of a public servant, because while it's important to take principled stands, a public servant's achievement is not in voting alone, but in working with others to accomplish things. And Ellen's record there has been very clear. Thanks to her, Atascadero is a safer, friendlier, more engaged community now than when she took office. And so on behalf of all Atascadarians, I'd like to thank you for your service.
Thank you, Mr. Latner.
Good evening, Mayor Fonse, members of the council. My name is Jim Patterson. I'm your 5th District Supervisor, and I just want to take this opportunity, like many speakers before me, to thank Ellen for her service on the council and also her years on the Planning Commission. I first met Ellen at a Atascadero Native Tree Association meeting many years ago. She just recently moved to Atascadero and wanted to get involved, and I think that was her first engagement in the community, and she moved on to the Atascadero Land Preservation Society and ultimately to the Planning Commission and then the City Council. And Ellen brings a unique perspective to the council, being a young working mother. Many of the residents of our community fit that model, and she speaks with that voice, and I very much appreciate it. Ellen, I wish you would convey our appreciation to your family for graciously and unselfishly.
Good evening, Council. My name is Mike Brendler. I live in Atascadero, and Ellen, I can attest that 2 years was a long time. I can only surmise that 4 years must have felt like an eternity, at least at times. I just wanted to say you did a very, very good job, and I don't say that lightly. You worked in a very trying environment, often a difficult environment, but you met the challenges that were presented to you. Now, when I shared the dais with you, you know, we agreed on some things, we disagreed on some things, but the qualities that I was most impressed with you was your commitment to your oath of office, your integrity, and your honesty. And in this day and age, I don't know that such values are widely shared among politicians, but you showed that there are some. So I'm sure you're looking forward to some decompression time, particularly here in the with the holidays coming up, more quality time with your family and your friends, and you richly deserve that. And so thanks again for the things that you championed and your commitment. It's been a pleasure to have worked with you.
Thank you, Mr. Brendler.
Good evening. My name is Doug Marks. I live here in Atascadero. Mayor Fonzie and members of the City Council, Len Colomarino has asked me to read the following statement commemorating the conclusion of Ellen Bayrou's distinguished term of service as a member of the City Council. And I must say at this point, this statement reflects the heartfelt sentiments of both Len and I. Thank you, Ellen, for all you have done for the Atascadero community and for so many of us individually. Your service during the challenging years when you have been on the City Council came at no small expense to you in terms of personal sacrifice. You never shrunk from the challenges. You stood up to all of the problems that have arisen and approached solving them with sound judgment, respect, and firm resolve. We all owe you a great debt of gratitude for your unselfish service and a salute of congratulations on your accomplishment for our community. Ellen, thank you so much. It has been our honor to have you serve on the City Council of Atascadero.
Thank you. Known as the Mean People. It's been a tough 4 years, and never did you try to retaliate. The reality is that after watching what you endured, no one on our side wanted to run. The atmosphere is too poisonous. And I know you would never say these things. You're always positive. It was with some pleasure in the last election that I watched the meanest of the mean pick two candidates and then marginalize and turn in the other two. Again, thank you, Alan. It was an honor to have worked on your campaigns. Your integrity is intact. You are a stronger person. And in my eyes, you have come out a winner. You did an excellent job of representing your constituency. Thank you for your continued support of the Atascadero Native Tree Association. And tell Francois, this is with tongue in cheek, he can settle down now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Keefe. Is there anyone else?
Good evening. My name is Marty Brown, and I'd also like to thank Ellen for her hard work and commitment to our city, and she has been a true inspiration. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. I think I will close the public comment portion and bring it back to the council. There are several that would like to speak as well on the council before we move to our first item. Council Member Kelly.
Yes, I won't be here next month, which will be, I think, Ellen's last meeting. And Ellen and I think we're on the Planning Commission for 4 years. And 4 years ago, she beat me to get on the City Council. And I'm here now, and Ellen has always been a gentlewoman. I've never seen her do anything mean, and we've always had some different ideas on things. All of us at times have been the lone person casting a vote, and we take heat for it, irregardless of what the subject is. On occasion, I've called Ellen at home to talk to her about things, and like everybody says, she's working like the rest of us don't. I have a regular job, and Francois, I will miss the conversations that we've had. In their past, they're very enlightening, and it's really been kind of interesting because each of us on the City Council have different interests, and Ellen's is different than mine, and mine is different than Ellen, although Ellen has opened my eyes to a few things in the environmental area. I'm not quite as far maybe as what she is, but I think it's all been an educational exhibit for all of us. And I actually will miss you, Ellen. It's been a pleasure working with you, and you've always been...
Go ahead, Ellen. I know you have something you want to say.
Well, I did prepare a short speech, knowing that I wouldn't really want to take up too much valuable time at our first meeting in December. But I just want to say that it's wonderful seeing so many friendly faces out there, and I know that not everybody has time to come to meetings, and it's always a pleasure when people actually stop me at work or stop me when I'm in the community and say, you know, I saw that council meeting and I really agreed with you, or even if they didn't agree with me, that they felt comfortable enough to come up and talk to me. So I have a little short speech at the end. I'm hoping it's going to be a short meeting, so if you're going to hang out for the bike plan and the code update, then you'll get to hear it then. But thank you all for coming. It's really nice.
Thank you, Ellen. And I would just like to add that it's been a pleasure working with you. We do not always agree, but we always can talk about it. You're always very open to discussion and have put a lot of hard work into this. We appreciate you very much. I'd like to bring back to the council's attention a couple of the comments that were given at public comment regarding the crosswalk safety, and wanted to direct a couple questions to staff that I think we all share in the concern and know that it has become a bit of a problem there, and the visibility is not good. And just wanted to ask the city engineer if he had any ideas on ways to make this a better and safer crossing.
Well, I think there's several options that we can look at, one being the lighted crosswalk. I know that you know, the mid-block crosswalks are that don't have stop control either by stop signs or signals are problematic. I think after hearing the latest accident out there, it does seem like there is an increase in accidents out there. So it's something we're going to be looking at lighting levels and the different solutions that would come back to you at some point.
Roberta,
could we
get consensus that on the council that we'd like to have staff address that that crosswalk?
Unless there's other questions, did anyone else have a question they'd like to ask? Councilmember Bayrou?
As you all know, I work at the state hospital, so I go by there all the time, and things, oh, it's clear, you know, and it's not. So there's a lot of different issues, but I do think it is an important safety issue to look at.
Councilmember Clay?
Yeah, one of the other problems is it's downhill, and anytime you have a situation where they're going downhill, you naturally speed up, especially with freewheeling. But I'd certainly like to see that addressed, and hopefully we can. Bob?
Yeah, I think if I heard correctly, the gentleman said there's been six people that have. Well, that's six too many, and. Normally, not addressing a Tascadero, but normally the way these things get fixed is somebody has to get killed, and then it comes to the top of the list. And I would say it needs to be a top priority within the city, and let's get it fixed before somebody gets killed down there.
I would agree. I think that there's several factors that make this a particularly dangerous area in terms of senior mobile home parks, people with limited mobility, the post office across the street from where they're trying to go, and a very long crosswalk and a big wide road.
Well, I think there's a lot of multifamily units down there that have
there
a lot of
are.
Young
yeah,
children
absolutely.
That yeah. maybe don't cross the street correctly, but we have to take care of that.
Mayor and Council, that has been an intersection that we have done some alternate measures for to try to slow things down. So we do understand your concern. We'll package that up and bring it back in prompt timing to get you some alternatives in front of you for how to take care of that intersection.
And in terms of contacting those that spoke on that subject tonight?
I've asked our staff to give them business cards so we can make direct contact.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Roberta,
Councilmember Clay.
Would it be all right if we took a break so Ellen could mingle with her friends out there before they leave? I would appreciate it.
I think that's
it.
A great idea. Yeah. Let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll return at 7:10. Thank you. Let's return to our seats and get on with the business that we have tonight.
But this has also been a rewarding project to work on because of the dedicated volunteers that have been involved with this project, that has worked with the city staff to develop the plan before you this evening. We have worked very hard over many months to put this plan together. We've had several public workshops. The Parks and Recreation Commission has held public hearings. We've had a joint meeting with the City Council. And so we think we're bringing a plan to you tonight that is an excellent bicycle transportation plan. Just to give a little background on this, the City Council in your strategic planning session earlier this year identified creating a bicycle master plan as a strategic priority. And so we put this on our project list for this year, even though there was no funding for it. As you may recall, in 2000, the city created a draft plan in 2000. For some unknown reason, it was never adopted, but that plan was done with a consultant, the cost of many thousands of dollars. This plan was done entirely in-house with our volunteers and our staff. In this slideshow I'm going to show you this evening, I decided to add a few slides that I didn't include when we talked about the bicycle transportation plan in September, because really when I went out into the community and started taking some pictures of our transportation or bicycle infrastructure, there's really a lot more out there than you maybe realize until you go out and inventory it all, and that's certainly something we did with the plan. In fact, the slide behind me here, this is over here on Lewis Avenue, close to the junior high, just on the other side of the bridge there. And you can see in a lot of these slides that I have coming up, really how we've enhanced and made safer, particularly the areas around schools, on some of our major arteries and in to our major destinations in town. Some of our surrounding and neighbor jurisdictions have already adopted a bicycle master plan. These plans have been implemented now for a little while, and we've seen the benefit of the plans that have accrued to those communities where they have brought in, say, tourism and different things because of their plan. They've brought in outside funding to improve their roads and their bikeways, and we've got a glimpse of what can happen here in Itasca, our local economy, and enhance tourism and build a safer and more livable community with a blueprint. This will be our blueprint for those improvements into the future. We've seen with some of the research that we've found, a growing demand for cycling facilities and improving circulation has been an ongoing goal of the City Council. This slide happens to show Atascadero Avenue that we were recently able to improve. And this is between Highway 41, which is behind us, looking down toward Atascadero Creek and going over to the high school. So again, you can see some nice improvements that we've been making over the last few years. It's really been dramatic and created a much nicer and safer circulation infrastructure for Atascadero. Bicycle infrastructure consists of a number of things. One, it's class 1, 2, and 3 bike paths, which I'll explain what those are in just a moment. It's also bridges, signage, bike racks, and things like that. On this particular slide, you can see a bike lane sign. This is on Traffic Way. And then this is the recently completed San Gabriel Road projects, the Routes to School project. And you can see we've got what's almost like a class 1 bike path here. It's separated from the road. You've got a curb separated and then a separate paved path. The only reason that wouldn't be a class 1 bike path is because it's not as wide as the specifications would call for, but certainly it serves as such.
here are the different types of bike paths, and I know for some people this is hard to understand, but essentially the class one path is what I just described. It's a separate paved path apart from vehicle traffic. And so that's something that's ideal. Normally it's 8 to 12 feet wide. In the middle here, this is a class 2, a bike lane. This is an example of a bike lane on El Camino Real. This is going northbound, northwest. This is San Jacinto behind us here. And you can see you've got a lane for parking on the street. You've got the bike lane, and then you've got the vehicle traffic lanes. Finally, the class 3 is essentially where the bicycles are sharing the road with vehicle traffic. And other than that, most of them are concentrated downtown. So we took that into account when we were looking at our routes and our facilities. These are the existing and proposed bicycle facilities, and I realize this is difficult to see, but this identifies all the different bike facilities that we have now and the ones that we're proposing, the bike routes and bridges, and also the bike plan routes, and the different colors designate the type of bike path or bike route. These are our community destinations on the map on the screen. The community destinations are points within the community that we feel the public is going to want to get to. That would be things like schools, the community center, City Hall, the Sunken Gardens, certainly the new theaters going in next door. So these are public and private facilities, and we're trying to make connections throughout the community so people can get to these areas on a bicycle. And this is the bike routes map, and this is similar to one of the others, but it does identify all the bicycle infrastructure that we have. And this particular slide shows a class 2 path, and this is over in front of Colony Hall or Best Western on El Camino Real going south. There are different projects that we've identified in the Bicycle Master Plan. The Bike Master Plan is essentially a 5-year document. One of the things that we'll need to do in 5 years is update this plan to keep it current, to make sure that we're continue to be eligible for funding. Although the Bicycle Master Plan does look out 5 to 15 years, and that's what you will see in the plan. The slide behind me indicates our proposed short-term improvements. You can see those are Highway 41 striping and signage, El Camino Real Class 2 bike lane gap closure projects, some of the bike lanes that I showed you just a moment ago on El Camino Real have some gaps. We want to close those. We want some designated bike route signage and striping, and class one at the north end of El Camino Real, and then also safe routes to school projects, class 1 through 3. So these will be the ones that we'd be applying for in the next year or so. This is the slide I just described that's in table 2.1, the short-term improvements. We've got some cost estimates there. You can see every one of them tonight in the interest of time, but I do want to go over some of the main ones. And I know at the last joint meeting with the Parks and Recreation Commission, we talked a little bit about the shalls and the shoulds in the plan, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that tonight as well. One of the policies is to update the engineering specifications to include bikeway improvement standards. This is actually something we're already doing in the Public Works Department. We're using the state standards already, so there's no real impact on the city on that type of thing from what we're already doing. New roadway development shall provide bikeways wherever feasible. This, again, is something that we're already implementing. New development adjacent to schools and community centers should include Class 1 bikeways to the facilities. You notice it says should there rather than shall. This is something that we're trying to do wherever feasible. And all of these all of these policies are non-binding. And so even if they do say shall rather than should, it's something that we're shooting for. It states our intention and our goals and objectives. The city should pursue regional, state, and federal outside funding, which, of course, is one of the main reasons we're putting together the plan. Our municipal code will be updated to require bike-friendly racks for all commercial and multifamily residential uses consistent with the Green Building Code. This is something that's already going to be implemented with or without the plan. Parking lots, park-and-ride lots should be included, and bicycle parking for commuters when feasible. We're going to work with SLOCOG and other agencies on this. City and the schools will work together to provide at least 10% of the school population for bike parking, so we'll look at, and that includes the staff at the schools as well as the children. The bike plan shall be consulted when assembling the capital improvement plan for the city. This is something that Public Works and all of the city staff do routinely anyway. In the plan, I want to point out this next policy is a change from what's written in the plan. We're going to change this to should. The city should strive to eliminate gaps in bicycle routes and prioritize route and continuity. So in the plan right now, it says shall. We're going to change that to should. Local bicycle projects should be coordinated with regional plans whenever possible. That simply makes sense and something that we would already be doing anyway. The city will also cooperate with other agencies to establish a connection from a task. Okay, the city should encourage new development to include facilities for changing and storing of clothes to encourage bicycle commuting. We want to enhance access and travel within the downtown with bicycle infrastructure. That's things like bike racks and things downtown to encourage people to use bicycles when they commute downtown. Bike lanes should not end abruptly, but should transition to existing improvements when possible. A lot of this kind of thing is very much common sense, but we're putting it in writing to make sure that as we pass this on from year to year, that we remember what our goals and objectives are. Also, this is one of the other ones. This is the second policy, which is actually in the maintenance portion of the policy document. Policy 18, the city should ensure street sweeping maintenance is extended to bike lanes, etc. Again, we think this is something that we're going to do anyway. If we're sweeping the streets, we're also going to end up sweeping the bike lanes, but we're changing the shall to should. So that would include the two changes being policy 10 and policy 18. And when we get to the staff recommendation, I'll point that out once again. We heard at the public hearing and joint meeting with the Parks and Recreation Commission some concerns about including Eagle Ranch in the bicycle transportation plan. Some of these routes and connections are identified in the general plan, but the City Council directed at that time that Eagle Ranch trail alignments and routes be determined as part of their specific plan in their EIR process. So that is occurring now. They're doing that type of planning. So there are some overarching goals in the bike plan. One is to increase safety, reduce bicycle accidents, mitigate traffic and parking congestion throughout Atascadero, facilitate mobility, getting people around town, attracting tourists to Atascadero, and encouraging healthy transportation choices. And we feel that the plan meets all of those goals. There's also a very large component in the bike plan, which I'm not going to enumerate tonight, that talks about maintenance, education, and collaboration, and there's a number of policies around all of those things. I do want to emphasize that a big part of this plan is educational workshops, working with other groups and agencies, regional cooperation and collaboration, and we want to definitely be a part of the transportation plan and beginning to apply for these funds with those projects that we identified as priorities for the first 5 years of the plan immediately. So we'll start that right after the first of the year, and we'll be just in time because we'll have adopted our plan in this year, this calendar year. So what's the fiscal impact of the plan? This is not a spending initiative. There are no projects that have been budgeted or programmed yet. Rough cost estimates are provided in $2,010, so if we don't get to, say, some of these projects in 5 years, obviously those costs may have changed. This will give the city the opportunity to go out and get funding for these beneficial projects that we might not otherwise be able to afford, especially now with these difficult financial era that we are experiencing, we'll be able to go out and access outside funding opportunities. And adoption by the this type of plan by other cities has been an economic stimulus, and this is something that's driving us as well. With that, I want to thank those individuals. We owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to the people who put in so much time, starting with the Parks and Recreation Commission. Dan Rivar is with the Slo County Bicycle Coalition. Gaiska Velasquez is with SloCog. Callie Taylor with Community Development. Dave Athey with Public Works. Lynn Colomarino, Doug Marks, Mike Zappas, Luke Knight, Jennifer Fanning, particularly Bill Wachtel and Tom Zirk from the Parks and Recreation Commission. They put in a tremendous amount of time, and I just want to make sure that everybody realizes how much work this was. I think we had the expertise in-house to do this plan rather easily. The difficult part was getting it done in such a short time frame, so we really had to ask people to a lot of meetings and get them out and hold workshops and do a lot of work in the last few months, and I think some of those people were tired of getting my emails, but I do want to thank them very much for all of their tireless efforts. They did a wonderful job, and we certainly couldn't have done it without them. So the staff recommendation tonight is to adopt draft resolution A, which certifies the proposed mitigated negative declaration 2010-006, and adopt resolution B, adopting the proposed 2010 bicycle plan with amendments to policies 10 and 18, as I noted in my staff report. And with that, we didn't change from shall to should, whenever feasible, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Those were the type of things like they would say the city shall work and coordinate with other agencies.
Sure.
Those are the kinds of things that mm-hmm. don't require us to implement anything other than, you know, getting together and working with somebody, with another agency, or sure. those types of things. So, yes, to answer your question.
Thank you. And, just thank everybody that did this because, it's obviously extensive and seems like they covered every little thing that they could. So I think it's a good plan and intend to vote on it.
Very good. No further questions. Let's open up to the public for their comments. Please approach the podium.
Thank you, Mayor Fonzie and council members. My name is Dan Rivoir, and I'm the executive director of the San Luis Obispo County Bicycle Coalition. It's been my pleasure working with your staff and our team of volunteers on this project. I'm very thankful that the council provided the strategic goal necessary to get this ball rolling and to provide the energy to go ahead and write the bicycle transportation plan. I'm here this evening to ask that you approve the 2010 City of Atascadero Bicycle Transportation Plan and certify the mitigated negative declaration. As you know, based on many of my previous visits to the council, an approved bicycle transportation thing is a very good thing for Atascadero. The benefits include, but aren't limited to, access to state and federal funds, the bicycle transportation account funds, which is over $7 million annually allocated to bicycle and walking infrastructure projects in California, improve safety for children biking and walking to and from schools and community centers, increased access to active transportation for community members, economic vitality, both through the cost savings made by community members and by encouraging tourism and enhancing recreational opportunities in Atascadero. Of course, reduced traffic congestion and reduced parking congestion in and around downtown areas and community centers. Improved behavior on behalf of cyclists and drivers alike. And, of course, many more things as well. So the benefits of having an approved bicycle transportation plan are great. And I'd also like to point out that as excited as we are and as happy as I am to be here today, to ask for your approval, our community members, how to bike safely and legally on the new infrastructure that they see throughout the community. We intend to collaborate on bike to work, bike to school days, and of course, any other of additional activities that city will be working on to make it a bike-friendly community. So I thank you so much that you've made it through this process. And once again, I'd like to ask for your approval and certification of the mitigated negative declaration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ruffoir.
Doug Marks, City of Atascadero. I seem to be the spokesman for Len Colomarino this evening. Len has asked me to present the following statement to you. Though I am out of town and unable to attend tonight's meeting at which you will be considering passage of the bicycle transportation plan, I wanted to express my support of the plan. As you know, I have been among those who have worked with a group of dedicated volunteers and city staff members in drafting the bicycle transportation plan. The combined efforts of all those who have contributed, including many members of the public who travel by bicycle or plan to do so, have yielded a plan that is comprehensive, thoroughly considered, and tailored specifically to the special characteristics of our community. As many of us know and appreciate, Atascadero is a place ideally suited to bicycling. With the adoption of the Bicycle Transportation Plan, we will be recognizing that and positioning Atascadero to realize its full potential as a bicycle-friendly city. Passage of the plan will go a long way toward promoting bicycle infrastructure, ensuring that bicycling is safe, accessible, and a convenient form of transportation and recreation in our community. Residents and visitors alike will be further encouraged to take advantage of Atascadero's special suitability for cycling. For these reasons, I join all of those who favor adoption of the Bicycle Transportation Plan. Thank you for considering my views on this matter. Signed, Len Colomarino. And at this point, I am happy to say that I concur with Len's sentiments and echo them as well. Thank you very much. A very happy Thanksgiving to you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marks.
Mayor Fonzie, members of the council, my name is Benefit. I think now is that the county has an approved plan, as does Paso Robles, and with the city of Atascadero having an approved plan, we're currently working on a North County Trails plan that would connect Santa Margarita with San Miguel. And having all of the links connected with approved plans will allow us to seek funding to help build the infrastructure that we'd need to accommodate cyclists from Santa Margarita all the way to San Miguel. And we actually have funding approved for an extension of a bike path from Templeton to South Paso Robles. So the links are beginning to connect. And I, again, just want to speak in support of staff's recommendation. I want to thank Brady Cherry. I want to thank the council for making the adoption of a plan a strategic goal for 2010, and you've succeeded. I was happy to attend the Parks and Rec Commission meeting last month when they unanimously approved this plan and sent it forward for your consideration. So again, I encourage you to adopt the plan and we can begin to build infrastructure throughout the North County.
One question for you, sir.
Yes.
Councilmember Clay.
Jim, what's the possibility of getting funding for a bike bridge across the Jack Creek so we could have the full extension from Atascadero to Paso Robles?
That's on our list. It's been a priority. SLOCOG is looking at that. In fact, Richard Murphy from SLOCOG is here tonight, and we were talking about it earlier. There is funding, $200,000 programmed for 2012 to begin the feasibility of looking at how we might make that connection. But it is a priority. It is something that we continually look for funding for. So you're absolutely right, Council Member Clay. It's a strategic piece, and it's what we need to get from Atascadero to points north. And we'll either connect with the Anza Trail down along the river or work with Caltrans and Union Pacific to get something up closer to the freeway, but it's a challenge, and it will be expensive, but it's certainly a key.
Good evening. Richard Mullen from Atascadero. I think this is a great plan, and in promoting tourism, I think about how many times I've put my bike on the bus to go to San Luis Obispo to ride the Bob Jones Trail, or now to go from San Luis all the way out to Avila Pier to have lunch. It's doable. I think the idea of connecting Atascadero to Templeton and Paso Robles, San Miguel, and Santa Margarita, I think that's an absolutely outstanding idea for our community, and I would encourage that to be maybe put up towards the high priority, because you get people like myself who will say, hey, let's ride to Temple. We live in Atascadero, but ride to Templeton and have lunch. Well, you get people in Templeton saying, hey, let's come to Atascadero and have lunch. So it's a great place to start to get our communities connected there. But I encourage you to adopt it and put the connection trail high on the priority list. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen.
Good evening, Mayor Fonzie and Council. My name is Mike Zappas. I'm a citizen of Atascadero, and I just want to urge you to pass this. It's a good start for our city, and it's something that we really need. And I also want to thank Brady for great leadership in this group. It was really a quick, like you said, it was a quick thing, but I think it was very thorough, and also Dan Rivara was very great in our group, and I just want to say it was an honor working with them all, and I hope you find it in your hearts to pass it tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zappas. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on this subject? Seeing none, I'm going to close it and bring it back to the council for deliberation. Councilmember Bayrou.
For me, a healthy community is one that exercises, and one thing you have to do is get out your front door, and if you don't feel safe getting out your front door and riding down the street, you're not going to do it. And I'm a pretty brave person, and I can take chances, but I know as a mother, you don't want to take chances with your kids. And if you can make those roads safer for your kids, and you can see from the slides that Brady showed us that we have put a lot of energy into the areas around our schools so they feel safer getting to school. But if we can do that citywide, just think of the possibilities for everyone in our community to get out and recreate more often. So that's real important to me. I do want to thank 9 months, or what is it? Yeah, about 9 months it took them to pull this all together. It's really remarkable, and we didn't have to pay for anything, which is even more remarkable in the land of government. One thing I do want to add is that this, as we know, has no funding, but I would like to request that that the council consider some limited funding at their strategic planning meeting in January to see what some small things we can do to increase, you know, some of the, we mentioned some of the smaller project of signage and paint on the road, so people are just more aware that the bicycles are there, and also to include the bike plan and some of the short-term projects in upcoming but the budget process, because if it's not in the budget, it doesn't happen. So we need to get council support for that. So I request that that be added to your list. I'm ready to make a motion whenever everyone's done talking.
I think there's more discussion. Well, Council Member Clay?
Yeah, I'd be happy to have Ellen make the motion. It's not a problem. But I would like to see more competitive events. Maybe Brady, remember we had bicycle racing. I remember the Bales of Straw was out on El Camino Real, and that was a great event. Before you all here, many years ago, there was a race that the JCs initiated from Atascadero. It went up through Creston and come back the old Rocky Canyon Road, and they had some high-powered bicyclists that were racing there, and some kid beat them all, you know what I mean, just on his own. So I'd like to see some events, if we could possibly, maybe the Recreation Commission could work on that, because they do draw people in. It's not just the bicycle people, but they bring people with them. So, I'd like to see that. And anytime Ellen wants to make the motion, fine.
I think Council Member Kelly had a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment and thank everybody that worked on this plan. It's really quite thorough, and I think the volunteerism
that came out in the city is really something to look forward to. I hope we can get more people to volunteer for some of these studies that we do. And I also want to thank the people of the community that also came out to support the plan. It just wasn't something that just happened between the city council staff and the parks and recreation. There's a community support behind it, which motivates us to move it up the list like everybody wants to do. So I just want to say thank you to the community. And Alan?
Thank you. I'd like to say just one very short one. When we passed this in strategic planning, I had some doubts whether it would come to fruition, because so often when you don't have any money, and we didn't, things just sit there. And we had people in the community, and Brady Cherry also, and members of staff that stepped up to the plate. When there's a will, there's a way. And the volunteers in our community and in our city have proven that, and I'm sure that we'll call on you again for other projects. We're still pretty broke, but we have things that we want to do because Atascadero is on the move. We appreciate you. Thank you.
And I also want to thank Tom O'Malley for being one of my cheerleaders on getting this as a priority for this year. So Tom's not here to toot his own horn, so I'm going to bring him up.
Let me make it simple for Tom and say thank you.
Yes, to say thank you. So I would like to suggest that the council adopts draft resolution A, certifying the proposed mitigated negative declaration, and adopt draft resolution B, adopting the proposed 2010 City of Atascadero Bicycle Transportation Plan as amended by staff for policies 10 and 18.
Wait a minute, Bob. On behalf of Tom O'Malley, I'll second the motion.
Okay, motion by Councilmember Bayrou, second by Councilmember Clay, a.k.a. Tom O'Malley. Roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Bayrou?
Yes.
Excuse me, Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Fonzie?
Yes.
4-0, motion passes.
Thank you, Marcia. Our next item for public hearing is adoption of the new 2010 California Building Codes and modifications to Atascadero Municipal Code. Staff report, please.
Yes, thank you, Mayor and Council. Tonight we are bringing before the City Council a series of code updates that we need to adopt. These are building codes that have been adopted by the State of California as part of the 2010 Building Code update. There's a number of components that are required to be adopted. The building official, the Public Works Department, the Fire Department, along with the planning staff, have been working for the last 6 months reviewing the new code updates and looking at appropriate local amendments that are included in our Title VIII, which is part of our municipal code that modifies the state code so it better fits here locally. So I'm going to turn it over to Ken Foreman, the building official. He'll walk you through what the proposed changes are tonight.
State codes are adopted on a three-year cycle. They're adopted on July 1st by the state, and they become effective the first day of the following year. Municipalities use that six-month period to do local modifications to the code, and local modifications must be based on climatic, geographic, or topographical or green conditions. And the modifications must be at least as restrictive as the California code. So here's a list of the codes we are adopting this year. As you can see, there's quite a long list. We have a new residential code to the state and also a new green building code. Locally, we're proposing to adopt the 2009 International Property Maintenance Code and the 2009 International Wildland Interface Code. So as part of our outreach program, we've done three presentations here at the City Council Chambers. On July 21st, we did a day-long presentation on the Green Building Code. On October 27th, we did another full-day presentation on the California Residential Code. And just a week or so ago, we did a meeting with the local construction community to talk about the new codes and our proposed local amendments. Ignition-resistant construction, which is it's typically one-hour fire-resistive construction, is required in high and very high fire severity zones throughout the city. These zones are also referred to as wildland interface areas, sometimes called WUI. We also propose modifications to our fire sprinkler ordinance, SOLS reports, and some clarification on grading requirements. The state has proposed changes on the gray water section of the plumbing code, and of course they've brought to us a residential code and a green building code, and then we'll speak a little bit about our local unreinforced masonry building program. So the city has three fire severity zones. The dark red zone on the lower area is the very high fire severity zone. The amber color, which encompasses most of the city, is our high zone. And then the yellow is our moderate zone. This map was developed by CAL FIRE and adopted by the city in 2004, and we've made no changes to it since then. So buildings that are constructed in the high or very high fire severity zones require this ignition-resistant construction. This type of construction it's an assembly. It typically has something like a stucco or hardy panel on the exterior walls. The roofing has to meet certain requirements, as well as the eaves and vents need to be a certain type that does not allow embers to go inside the building. Windows in these areas are required to be dual glazed with one layer of tempered glass. And a significant change we're proposing this code cycle is to exempt buildings that were constructed prior to October 5th of 2004. And the significance of that date is that was the first effective date of the city adopting wildland interface construction requirements. So the exemption here would be to for additions or modifications to buildings built prior to that date. Other significant modifications is we're trying to combine the high and very high fire severity zone requirements, so there will be one single list of requirements. We're also proposing to allow open eave construction. We've in the past required all eaves to be boxed in, but this open eave construction would be allowed if all exposed framing is at least a two bi-dimensional lumber. So that would include rafter tails, the blocking in between the trusses or rafters, and the decking above. Additional options for exterior wall protection can be found on the State Fire Marshal website. There are options besides the stucco and hardy panel siding. So typically, new buildings require fire sprinklers. That's been a requirement in the city since 2005. The exceptions for new buildings would be an office or retail building less than 500 square feet, and also for detached private garages, accessory buildings, or agricultural buildings that are less than 1,000 square feet. Existing buildings, when you add on a room addition or change the use to a more hazardous use, often trigger fire sprinklers. Exceptions to those would be an addition to a commercial building that's less than 10% of the area of the existing building, provided the building and the addition and the existing building do not exceed 2,000 square feet, and a second story is not added, and it does not the use does not change to something more hazardous. And we're also proposing a relative hazard category table that you can see if the number four category, those are different types of building occupancies. If you move up the table to a lower number, that would trigger fire sprinklers. We're proposing a new additional exception to office and retail buildings, provided the if the addition is less than 1,000 square feet, a second story is not added, and the combined area of the addition and the existing building does not exceed 5,000 square feet. Residential buildings that do not have fire sprinklers are required to install fire sprinklers if they do a room addition that exceeds a certain limit. So our limit on our current code is 3,000 square feet. So if you had a residence that's 1,000 square feet, you could actually add on another 2,000 square feet to that residence before you trigger fire sprinklers. For buildings that are already 3,000 square feet or maybe even larger, we're proposing an exception that would allow 10% of a room addition, provided the entire structure does not exceed 5,000 square feet. With our last code adoption, when the state adopted the international codes, the SOLS report requirements got quite restrictive. So in order to address that, we're proposing this code cycle to allow a room addition on a residence that's 1,000 square feet or less without a SOLS report, and also a detached accessory structure that's less than 1,000 square feet to be built without a SOLS report, provided a licensed architect or engineer visits the site, observes the soil conditions, and designs the foundation for that structure based on those conditions. The city has used Appendix J historically for their grading requirements. We have some minor modifications to Appendix J to meet the requirements of the stormwater management plan. These requirements are not intended to create any new regulations, but just to codify existing regulations and existing staff policy. In August of 2009, there was an emergency legislation that allowed gray water systems in residential applications to be installed without a permit for closed washer systems and single fixture systems. The plumbing code is now revised to allow closed washer systems only without a permit. So our new California residential code applies to one- and two-family residential buildings not to exceed three stories in height. And fire sprinklers are now, with this new code, going to be required in residential in new residential buildings statewide. The residential code is designed to allow people to build a house without using a licensed architect or engineer, provided they follow the cookbook-type methodology that's listed in the residential code. If somebody was to build a residence and not follow that prescriptive requirement, then they would be required to hire a licensed architect or engineer and use the requirements in the California Building Code. So decks have historically been exempt from a building code, provided they're 30 inches or less above grade. The new residential code now will require a permit for decks if they're attached to a building. There is a still an exception for decks from permit requirements, provided the deck is detached, provided it's less than 200 square feet, less than 30 inches above grade, and provided it does not serve as part of the required exit path. Smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors are going to be required in new construction for residential buildings. The carbon monoxide requirement is new. They are also required to be installed if you do an alteration that's greater than $1,000, the value of the alteration. And that does not include typical maintenance on a house. It's actually improvements. Our green building code consists of mandatory and optional requirements. Tier 1 and Tier 2 are in the appendix, and those are the optional, more restrictive requirements, which we are not adopting locally this code cycle.
In 1995, the city contracted with a local architect to survey the city and prepare a list of potential unreinforced masonry buildings. Soon after that, the city adopted an ordinance that required all the buildings to be evaluated, and if they were determined to be unreinforced masonry buildings, they must undergo a seismic retrofit or be demolished by January 1st of 2005. So today we have cleared 23 buildings from that list. We still have 9 buildings that remain. Here's a map showing the location of these the remaining buildings on the list. Two of the buildings are the Historic City Hall and the Printery Building. We have these other two buildings and these four here on this slide that are still on the list. There was a recent court ruling on a Paso Robles case that determined that URM buildings are going to remain liable for damages or injury caused by their unreinforced masonry buildings, even if the city allows a time extension for bringing these buildings into compliance. So it is a benefit to the city and to the building owners to work on these buildings, to have them evaluated and determine the status and whatever improvements are necessary. The staff is proposing an outreach program to contact the owners of the buildings and inform them of the requirements. As part of this outreach, we have discussed the costs of retrofitting buildings with a local testing agency, and this local testing agency has worked with engineers on seismic retrofit programs, buildings, and they've informed us that to evaluate the buildings, it's between $2,000 and $3,500. To have reports and plans prepared can be anywhere from $3,500 to probably $5,000. So from $2,000 to, say, $8,500, building owners can have the buildings evaluated and have the plans prepared if necessary to make the necessary repairs. So that concludes the presentation. We discussed the 3-year code adoption cycle, the new codes, local amendments, and the unreinforced masonry buildings. And I'll be here to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foreman. Are there any questions? Councilmember Kelly?
Yeah, I just have a question on the SARLS reporting for the single-family residents. I believe you said that up to 1,000 square feet that a SARLS report wouldn't be required if an architect or engineer observed the property to be okay. I'm just wondering how the 1,000 foot was determined in difference to, say, if somebody wanted to build a 1,500 square foot house on the same property with the same soils condition.
Well, this would not be for new construction. A new house requires a soils report. What we're proposing is what we do know that modest projects now with the soils report requirements are, the soils report is, I believe it's in the $3,000 range. So it can make a very modest project fairly expensive. So we're just trying to come up with an area. It's consistent with some of our other ordinance requirements as far as the 1,000 square feet, just to allow an existing or an addition to an existing building or a detached accessory structure.
Okay. Just one other question on the dual glazed windows that are going to require one panel to be tempered.
Yes.
Do you know what the reasoning was behind that? I can see a lot of benefits from it, but I can also see some hazards if people were trying to get out of a house and trying to break that glass.
Well, that has to do with flying embers. And it's a requirement that CAL FIRE determined through their testing. My understanding is most dual glazed windows are manufactured that way now because this requirement is statewide. Does that answer your question?
Well, I'm sure they're required if it's statewide. I was just was wondering what the thinking was behind it, and yeah, I guess you didn't make it, so that's okay.
This is not a local modification.
Okay. Thank you.
Councilmember Clay?
Well, on the dual pane windows, wouldn't it be that they wouldn't explode in the, if the heat was, you know, extreme?
I'm sure that's part of it. They go through an extensive testing procedure, yeah. And that's what the Cal State came up with.
Then I have a question about ag buildings. You know, we have a lot of horse people around in the 10,000 square feet. Is that adequate? Should it be more? And then what is the cost of sprinkling a building that's, say, 12,000 square feet?
My understanding is, and this may be a little outdated, but I think fire sprinklers are about $3 a square foot.
$3. Figure that out for me, would you?
For a what? The size?
Say 12,000 square
that
foot.
That would be $36,000.
Whoa.
Big barn.
Yeah. So I guess my question is why the...
Yep. I agree. Mr. Peterson, go ahead.
Well, the fire department.
Okay, good. I'd appreciate that.
Typically, the going cost right now for fire sprinklers is right around $1.05 to $1.25 a square foot. That's the going cost. Remodels are a little more expensive, and that's maybe where Mr. Foreman was going. Typically, those will run in the $4 to $5 square foot range.
On the remodel, so $12,000 would maybe be $13,000, $14,000 added to a
on a 12,000 square foot, yeah, building, you're looking at about $1, $1.25, okay. You know, per foot.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you.
You bet.
Sounds reasonable if you say it real fast.
I had a question also about the ag buildings, the rationale behind it, that normally you think of sprinklers being required in a building that's inhabited, but a barn or accessory structure or a garage probably is not inhabited. So why the sprinklers?
I think Tom will take this one too.
Madam Mayor, typically on an ag building, when we're looking at a building that needs to be sprinkled, we're looking at the type of occupancy, and then we have to look at fire flow. And on ag buildings and in each particular lot, we have to look at the amount of fire flow that's required for that particular parcel, and the more buildings we add, the more fire flow. So by adding a building, we minimums... Excuse me, I got to switch glasses. Minimum fire flow is 1,000 square feet on a typical structure, one- and two-family dwelling. When we exceed that, then that fire flow goes up. And if it exceeds what can be provided, then it would require sprinklers to reduce that.
Councilmember Clay?
What's fire flow?
Fire flow is 1,000 gallons a minute.
Okay.
And that's what comes out of the hydrants.
Okay, but generally speaking on sprinklers, what I've always heard is they don't save the building, they save lives. So, you know.
No, typically in you know, sprinkler buildings nowadays, they save the buildings.
Also.
I mean, yeah, even in our 13D systems, which are residential systems,
right.
Those are extinguishing fires. We just recently had one about 2 months ago that saved a unit at the north end of town. That was unoccupied, and the bell had been going off for a period of time, and it actually extinguished a fire, and that would have been undetected for a long period of time.
Right. Okay, so you think the 10,000 square feet is reasonable? I'm sure you're going to say yes, but...
the 10,000 square
foot let me, for an let me, ag building. Let me help there a little bit. I think we've added a zero. It's actually 1,000 square foot is the exemption.
Doggone it. You mean I couldn't get away with that, Wade?
No.
Yeah,
okay.
I was
all right.
Curious on the
1,000 square feet. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, isn't it true that, you know, if you have a major fire going on next to your house is at risk? And that you would prefer to have all your property protected by sprinklers? Because, well, I think a dollar square foot doesn't sound unreasonable. But I know on my street when the garage was on fire and they were worried about it catching the house on fire. So, I mean, I think that's another rationale for having everything sprinkled.
Correct. And when we're looking at fire flows, the code requires, as I stated, 1,000 gallons a minute minimum to even be able to build on a parcel. There are a lot of hydrants in our outlying areas that won't put out 1,000 gallons a minute. So therefore, with the new sprinkler ordinance that Ken was talking about, that allows some of those parcels to be developed. If they didn't have sprinklers, they wouldn't meet that minimum fire flow requirement, so there would have to be some alternate means. The code allows a 50% reduction in the fire flow when a house is sprinklered. So therefore, it goes from 1,000 gallons a minute to 500 gallons a minute because of the addition of the fire sprinklers. So therefore, by adding an ag building of 5,000 square feet, that would need a fire flow of 2,000 gallons a minute. A lot of our outlying hydrants would not be able to accommodate that. And if we add fire sprinklers to those, they can the fire flow of that outlying hydrant can accommodate that now.
Other questions for him? I'd like to change the subject slightly from the ag buildings and bring it to the residential structures that are adding an addition. That the previous councils had decided that 3,000 square feet was the maximum number of square feet for a building when it was adding an addition. Looking back on that, can you see any rationale that supports that, or could it be 3,500 or 4,000 or any other number that could come up?
Well, that's what we did, increase and allow the benefit of going to 5,000 square feet on additions, but not to exceed 10%. The way the original code was written was they couldn't exceed 3,000 square feet at all. So there, once they went 3,001 square feet, they had to fire sprinkler. So a modest addition on a 3,000 square foot or over structure, they would have to add fire sprinklers. What we did allow was the exception in the R3s that allow them to add the 10% up to 5,000 square feet.
Right. I understand that. But if you had a house that was 3,000 square feet, 10% would be 300. So the maximum size would be 3,300.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you're saying increasing the total size?
Yeah. If 5,000 is your limit, why don't we just make it a 5,000 square foot house?
Well, again, that's based on the fire flow. And when you look at, which glasses do I have? Let me find my table here.
Sorry, but I like things logical, and this seems illogical to me.
In Appendix B of the fire code, it talks about fire flow requirements. And if you look at the table in Appendix B, on a Type 5 basic construction, the minimum fire flow for a structure of 0 to 3,600 square feet is 1,500 gallons a minute. So therefore, that's where that number came from. If we exceed 3,600 square feet, and we're talking about a one- and two-family dwelling, then we can go to that 1,000-gallon-per-minute minimum. And those are set by the state and the state fire marshal.
So in other words, we're 600 square feet below, and perhaps we should raise it to the 3,600 square feet?
Let me try the tag team approach. What we were thinking about, we basically went back and looked at the kinds of requests.
Who might you be?
I'm sorry. I might be Chief Kurt Stone from the fire department. We went back and looked at the kinds of requests that came in, and we really felt, in working with Ken and Warren, that we came up with a system previously that was too punitive towards remodels. So let me explain. If you had a 2,800-square-foot house and you wanted to add a 300-square-foot bathroom, you'd have to sprinkler the entire house because it pushed you over the 3,000-square-foot limit. And to answer your question directly, so we tried to build in relief for those individuals. And then, Madam Mayor, to answer your question directly, the biggest impact is the number of staffing members in the fire department that it takes to fight a fire. As you add larger buildings that are unsprinklered, it requires more staffing. And we did the calculations. Now I'm using his notes. Calculations for a 1,000 square foot or a building that requires 1,000 to 1,500 gallons per minute requires 17 fire personnel to extinguish the fire. When you start to grow those buildings to 3,000 and 5,000 square foot, the number of firefighters goes up 3, 4, 5, and at 5,000, 6 additional personnel to fight those fires. And so that was our rationale for cutting it off at 3,000.
But if I'm following this correctly, I had a house that was 3,000 square foot and I wanted to add on 2 bedrooms, I had 2 more kids, I can't do that at the current time without sprinkling my entire house, correct?
Under the current code, correct. But if those 2 bedrooms were 300 square feet or less, you could add, make that addition without sprinkling the entire house.
With the current proposal.
Thank you.
But that square footage takes in the garage too, doesn't it?
An attached garage, correct, yes.
Those are the complaints that I have been getting, because a lot of your new houses will have a 3-car garage, which is right around 850 square feet. And then you have a house that might be 18 or 22. And I think the biggest gripe has been is that there's a 1-hour firewall between the garage and the houses. And a lot of people feel it's unfair that they have to go to the extra expense for this very expensive sprinkler system, which you say is $4 or $5 a square foot cost, when they, basically the garage is fire protected from the house with the firewall. That's been one of the biggest gripes that I've heard in town.
Right. Actually, with the new code, they've actually reduced the fire rating between the separation between the garage and the house. So that has been somewhat lost. Where it used to be 5/8 type X separating the two and the 1-hour door, those types of things, those have been reduced to 1/2-inch sheetrock and a 20-minute door. So those have been reduced with the addition of the sprinkler code in the new code adoption.
Right. But I know my experience, all the older houses had the 1-hour firewall and the door and everything in there. And it just felt, it seemed to me that it was unfair that the garage was taken in when it was really kind of isolated from the house already by fire protection. And I kind of go along with Mayor Fonzi. I think there needs to be a little more leeway that if somebody wants to put on, just like you say, a couple extra bedrooms, the 300 feet or so on a 3,000 square foot house, or if you went back to just the square footage of the controlled part of the house, you know, where the people live, and put some formula in there, I think that would be more fair. But the garage deal can really throw it out of whack.
Yeah,
I think.
You're referring to the conditioned space inside.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's typically where we have, you know, the separation and on a detached, which we've been seeing a lot more of, garages, we don't require them to be sprinklered. And it's not part of the actual square footage to the house. But when it is attached, I've got some numbers that on S and U occupancies, so a U occupancy is basically a garage. We're looking from nationally from 2003 to 2007. There have been 24,000 fires. 10,000 of those are in those outbuildings, U occupancies, S occupancies. Another 4,900 were in residential garages. So when we're looking at fire starts, we're looking at the prime area where we see undetected fires going unchecked for long periods of time. It's not like starts in a kitchen where we just had one recently. People detect it immediately and they can take action on it. Garage starts, especially on attached garages, go undetected for long periods of time, allowing the fire to grow. And that's where we run into issues.
Would it be, under what we have here, if we had a policy, if they had a 1-hour firewall, and if you took the conditioned space of the house and increased that to 20% before sprinklers were required? Because it seems like if you start getting the square footage of bedrooms and everything compared to a house, it seems like that 20% is probably a more realistic number for a minimum addition to a house. Is that something that we can work with within our city codes?
We would actually, I would defer to Ken on that, but I don't think we can go back and require 1 hour.
Well, no, that would be a condition. If they wanted to upgrade that firewall that wasn't an hour, they would have to do that if they wanted to take advantage of the 20% increase and eliminate the square footage of the garage within the formula.
I think that's something that we can discuss and get back to you on.
We can look at that.
That's an easy fix.
Or on the flip side, we could increase it to 3,600 rather than 3,000, which is allowable, as you stated, by the state. Correct?
That's the fire flow minimums, correct.
Yes, thank you.
Is this something maybe we would let them work over and come back? And
it is a local policy, and it is up to the council to make the policy, if I'm understanding this correctly.
Yes, to a certain degree, correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. Very good. Any other questions for Mr. Peterson or Chief Stone? Thank you. We appreciate that. Any other questions for staff? I did have one for Mr. Foreman regarding the seismic retrofit. You talked about the buildings that had gone beyond the 2005 deadline and were out of compliance. They had not been reinforced.
Yes.
At this stage, can you give us the consequences for those property owners? Are they given some kind of a citation at this point in time, or what is exactly the means that
we work with? There's been incremental requirements. They are required right now to be signed, but according to our ordinance, they should be retrofitted. So I think if we work with them, explain the costs involved without the cost of actually doing the retrofit, but the preparation, I think the unknown of what's out there, and there's a lot of kind of horror stories about how much it costs to retrofit a building. I think we can work with them. I think the initial enforcement action would be to require the building to be vacated. That would hopefully encourage some compliance, but it really wouldn't. It would only buy us a little bit of time because the building is still there and the public is still around.
I guess this would be a city attorney question. That it was mentioned about this lawsuit in Paso Robles that dealt with a unreinforced masonry building. Apparently the city was not charged, although they were seen as being partially liable in the beginning, but they were held unliable later. Are you familiar with the case, or do you know anything about this?
Well, no, but the mere fact that a lawsuit's filed doesn't mean there's liability. So based on your description of it, it sounds like that initially there were allegations of liability, and eventually either through whether a settlement or trial was found that they were not liable.
Well, let's just put it in the terms for our city. If we have a unreinforced masonry ruling that we need to be reinforcing them and they are currently out of compliance, is there liability for the city if we don't enforce that compliance?
If the city owns the building, there could be a risk. But if it's the building is not owned by the city, then the answer is no.
Okay. That I can see some issues with vacating buildings since some of these are downtown. We're trying to fill the buildings, and we don't want to board them up or have any other blighted conditions. I'm wondering if there's some other way to go about this and get the compliance through helping them apply for any grants that may be available or money that may be at the state or some other way to assist them.
We will continue to investigate those, but there isn't a lot of that money available. I mean, there's a variety of these buildings across the state. You know, that's something we've kind of had our eye on, and there isn't easy grant monies available for these private properties.
I have a question.
Councilmember Plain.
Could we use redevelopment money in regards to loans that are secured by the property and to help the business, the property owners develop that? Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility. It's we've sort of explored that. There's a variety of difficulties in it. You just mentioned a secured loan, so maybe there's some opportunities there. You know, in these economic times, it's hard to have a secured loan, but that's a potential opportunity. The grant thing is much more difficult from the standpoint of public funds. But there are certainly some opportunities we could review and get you information back on in that area.
Okay, because, you know, some of the buildings may be fully, you know, paid for. They're old buildings. There's a possibility that you'd even get a first or something like that. The other thing is, on regards to insurance, are these buildings being insured properly? Do we know? Or with the ruling in Paso Robles, it seems like that would affect their insurance. Because they held the property owner liable, even though the city had given them an additional, you know, 5 years or whatever to do to fix their building.
Well, I don't think we could tell you the ins and outs of the Paso Robles case. Remember, it was a 2003 case, and the, you know, the final date of the URM enforcement was following that. So the city, like us, we've been pursuing these buildings to be repaired, and the city had been pursuing those buildings to be repaired. Now we're outside that time frame.
Well, thank you.
Just thank you. I'm sorry. And just a question regarding those that are on the sidewalk. It's not just the tenants in the building. If we make it vacant, that's part of the problem and a major part. But those that are on the street also have some safety issues with an unreinforced building. Is that not correct?
That is correct. We don't think vacancy is necessarily the compliant option.
Okay. Thank you. We need to consider whether we want a motion. We want to take portions out of this. We'll open this up to the public again, too. Let's go ahead and do that. Is there anyone in the public that would like to speak on this topic? If so, please approach the podium. I'll close it to the public and bring it back for deliberation among the council members.
I'd like to get a little more input maybe on the sprinklers and see if there's maybe a way to modify that that's satisfiable to the fire department and make it more realistic to the people in the community that do want to put small additions on their house.
Mayor and Chairman, maybe I could offer a suggestion. If we could sort of wrap our arms around that parameter that you described earlier, something between what's currently proposed in the ordinance to 3,600 to a potential 20% increase based on a one-hour firewall, adopt with that envelope, adopt the first reading of this ordinance. In the second reading, we'll bring back that analysis with those three options. You'll wrap up the ordinance and be able to then implement it at the beginning of the year.
I'll make that motion.
Do it, Bob.
Okay, I'd like to ask the maker of the motion if they would consider an amendment based on the size of the home, whether there could be an addition to an ag building to make up that 3,600 square feet for the fire flow, because I can see someone with a small home with a big barn or would like to build a big barn, and this would be the same amount of feet. Perhaps there might be an exemption for an ag building as well.
I think we can work that in the motion and achieve what we want to tonight. Is that correct?
We can continue. We can evaluate the size of the ag building on respect to the gallons, this gallon issue. We start to get to a technical gallon issue that, you know, will be different to each parcel, and we'd really rather keep you to a policy level decision on these areas. To the extent we can do that, and at the same time, just recognizing that we all know that most of these starts occur in that garage for some reason, whatever is left in the garage, it doesn't usually occur in the other rooms of the house, or as often. So we want to be careful about what we're providing, but we understand you with respect to additions and ag buildings.
Okay.
Right?
Is that the motion? I'll second it.
Motion by Councilmember Kelly, second by Councilmember Clay. Discussion by Councilmember Bayrou.
Because currently, if it's over 1,000 square feet for ag and accessory buildings, it has to be sprinkled. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so the proposal is to change the policy that it would allow it up to 3,600?
No.
Just to look
at it.
Just to look at it and come back with some more information on it.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I just want to make sure what was being said. Okay.
I think there's a difference between ag and accessory, but in my opinion, is a barn for hay or horses or something like that. You know,
we agree. We understand what you're saying, but that is one of the difficulties. You know, once we call something an ag building, there is a legal definition of it. And although we had something in mind, as people are bringing something to the counter, we're required to enforce the legal definition of that. And so that's a little spooky in that, because we actually do it under those occupancies that we were talking about, you and whatever. And so it could encompass things you didn't really want to encompass, and that's what we're fearful of.
Okay. So we got a second and a
We do. Yeah. Motion by Councilmember Kelly, second by Councilmember Clay. Roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Bayrou?
Yes.
Mayor Fonzie?
Yes.
4-0, motion passes.
Thank you, Marcia. That concludes our public reports tonight, and we're moving on to management reports. There are none. Any council announcements or reports? Council Member Clay.
Yeah. Hey, I got a very important announcement. I hope everybody out there is looking at me and listening. It's going to be in the mid-20s today. It's going to be in the teens tomorrow and probably in the teens for a couple of days. People are going out of town. We've had this happen in the past a few years back. Some of you that have been here remember. It was a Christmas. Everybody went out of town. We had the similar thing with the low temperatures. The pipes broke. There was, I don't know how many houses around here, Kurt would probably know, that were flooded in immense cost to them. So tell your neighbors you got to leave the heat on a little bit, you know, at 65 or something, or you got to leave some water dripping in your, you know, so that you have some flow through your place, or we're going to have a disaster come, you know, about the weekend. So please, please talk to your neighbors, and if you're out there listening, take care of business, because it will happen, and it's going to get real cold.
Thank you. Very good point. Others? Councilmember Bayrou?
It's a lot less people in the room, but I didn't want to take up time earlier for my little farewell address, I guess you can call it. I just want to say it's been an honor to represent you and the varied interests of our community. It's been a long 4 years and a quick 4 years. You know, when you're really busy, time does go by fast. As mayor in 2009, I strive to be fair, honest, and to treat everyone with respect. For me, civility at council meetings was my goal. I have dealt productively and respectfully with all issues that came before the council, and I'm proud to have retained my personal integrity in an often discourteous environment. How could I leave without a brief summary of some key issues? I never liked the word Walmart. It always kind of brought up all these emotions. But whether you hate it or love it, the corporation has independently proposed a much smaller store, and it's a size within our general plan, luckily for us. And the EIR, as stated earlier, will be ready for public review in January. And I know it seems like we've talked about Walmart forever, but it still has not technically been approved. And the project does come back for approvals in the spring, and citizen input will continue to remain really important. Creek setbacks. This important environmental issue has come full circle, and the Regional Water Quality Control Board is requiring the city to comply with setbacks were very similar to the original ordinance in 2007, and that's still going to be reviewed by the city. Open space and protection and public access. We used designated funds to support the Atascadero Land Preservation Society's purchase of the Davis property along Highway 41, also known as the Three Bridges property. And this property also borders the Eagle Ranch, where links to the National Forest will add wonderful recreational opportunities for residents and attract visitors to our community. And I think this is really, for me, one of the most exciting things that's going to be happening in the near future for Atascadero. The bicycle plan, I'm very happy that that has really come to fruition. I crossed my fingers when we said we would work on it this year, and I'm really happy that we got it in there right before I left. So, you know, this plan will guide future road development, it will enhance our bike routes, and it will attract tourists who want to cycle here. And I think you hear that a lot from the people who do cycle, because when we go on vacation, we cycle where we go, too. And that happens all around the world. Most importantly, our city will be eligible for the government grants and will complete some of those identified needs and finally connect our neighboring communities without the need of a car. And I can't tell you, I've done that little section between Templeton and Atascadero. I'm telling you, you bite your nails on that. Okay, it's not fun to be on the freeway with all those cars. Even doesn't matter how brave you are, and you're never going to want your kids to do that. So we got to make sure we get that one done. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions. At the local level, this means increasing energy efficiency and improving public transit systems to reduce our oil consumption. The city has already started some of those changes, and we need to do that individually in our homes, and we can make a big difference. The city is part of a collaboration of small cities in the county to develop a climate action plan, and that's going to be happening in the next year. Local enforcement of the federal law prohibiting tobacco and drug paraphernalia sales to minors. Though that was defeated at our last meeting, 3-2, I hope the public will return to compel the new council to take action to reverse the dismal statistics in Atascadero. The teenage smoking rate of 22% of sophomores at the high school, and shamefully, 32% of our retailers break the law and sell to minors. I believe the council can do more to support our youth in making healthy choices. Lastly, building public trust was a crucial issue, which could have greatly improved the connections between different segments of our community by encouraging citizens to be part of the city council. The idea seemed easy, but it was not consistently supported. An ordinance to reasonably limit campaign spending was repealed before an election was held, which gives advantage to candidates of monetary means. A consideration of an increase in council members' pay was disregarded, discouraging working-age citizens from contemplating public service. On the positive side, we do have candidate forums to encourage ethical campaign practices and for public education during the election season. Also, campaign contributions are posted on the city's website, and I want to thank Marcia for getting that one, because that was a dicey one trying to get that squared away. But these are all tools that the citizens can use during the campaign season. If I can leave you with a thought, it is this. Good decisions arise when all voices are heard and varied opinions are considered on factual merit. I encourage all of you, especially my colleagues on the City Council, to model your behavior that you want to see and support leaders who do the same. It is no great feat to listen respectfully to those who share your opinion. Respect is demonstrated in how you listen to those with different opinions from your own. Honor and integrity are demonstrated when you make difficult decisions, possibly unpopular with your friends, but in the lasting interests of the community. As a mother of two, it is time for me to focus on my family. My husband and children have been so patient with my commitment to community service. Anna and Scott are now teenagers. I know it's hard to believe. All too soon they will be venturing off, and I need to spend time with them now. I have plans to return to politics in the future. How soon is an open question. I would like to thank Sorrel Marks, who has served all 4 years on the Parks and Rec Commission, giving valuable input and encouraging respectful public participation wherever our incredible parks are concerned.
That's it. Thank you, Ellen. Any other council members' reports? No? Okay. Is there any committee reports? I just have one brief one, if no one else does. I'm going to the mayor's luncheon very shortly, and it's being hosted by the city of Morro Bay. Janice Peters has been their mayor for some time, and she did not run for office. I do have a card here that I'd like to have you sign, if you would, before you go home, so that we can give that to her when we see her next time.
Could I say one thing?
Yes, you may.
Yeah. Well, I just want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, and take care of that water, folks, or you're going to be very sorry. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Is there any staff announcements or information that we need?
No report.
Very good. Well, happy Thanksgiving, and meeting adjourned.